From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. With Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and now Nevada behind us, the media have been abuzz this week with coverage of the GOP frontrunner.
Senator Marco Rubio, now the favorite of the Republican establishment.
This political horse race is in the final stretch and headed to the finish line. And the Rubio campaign is reaching for the win.
It's really a two-person race, and ultimately Rubio will still win.
Yeah, that's right. Marco Rubio. Granted, he isn't technically the frontrunner in the very narrow sense that he hasn't run in front. But he's placed third, fifth, and second place twice. So why quibble? Second place is exactly like first place, if you look at it a certain way. And the media certainly do.
Saturday night, while Marco Rubio was celebrating a second-place win in South Carolina,
comes back, turns it all around, comes in second in South Carolina.
Rubio has been racking up endorsements ever since he came out of South Carolina with that big second-place win. But
not just a second-place win. If you just ignore Donald Trump's 73,970 more votes, Rubio was second in a landslide. Hell, when you're willing to airbrush out an entire candidate, even third place is first place.
Donors rallied around Rubio after his third place victory in the Iowa caucuses.
Stick that third place in your eye. V-I-C-T-O-R-Y. And don't get brainwashed by those self-important, you know, states with their so-called primaries and caucuses. Do they really matter? Not according to our frontrunner.
Well, first of all, we have to understand that you don't win the nomination by how many states you win.
Again, if you're going to be a stickler, that may be exactly how you win the nomination. But come on, look at his endorsements.
People like Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota. Bob Dole, the former senator, former presidential candidate.
Rubio picked up the most coveted endorsement in South Carolina from Governor Nikki Haley.
Well, it looks like the Haley bump may have pushed Marco Rubio all the way to second place after all.
Here's Congressman Crescent Hardy explaining to MSNBC's Thomas Roberts that he supported Rubio because
we need somebody that's going to have a plan. Marco Rubio has a plan. He's discussed those plans. I believe it's the right direction to go, and I think that he can accomplish that.
But is there one thing you could name over the last year that you've seen firsthand on the Hill that he has done that demonstrates presidential character to be able to get things done?
On the Hill, I have not seen that. He's been running for a presidential race most of this year.
A full-throated endorsement, if ever there was one. If not necessarily for Rubio's record or policy positions, but for his inspiring lack of being Donald Trump. This is what happens when the unthinkable stares a party and a press corps right in the face. As someone who himself utterly dismissed Trump's prospects as recently as 2 months ago, believe me, I understand. But it's not just the weird combination of wishful thinking and abject denial. There's also a growing boosterism in which the media have become de facto volunteers in the Rubio campaign. Why, we're even helping with strategy.
Marco Rubio needs to start winning.
We're going to have to win some states and win some big delegate counts.
Rubio needs a win somewhere.
Marco Rubio really does need a victory.
One final note from a Republican I spoke with who said sooner or later, he needs to win a state and not just finish second or third.
Now, there's some shrewd analysis. In order to win, he has to start winning. It's practically a lock. Rubio says so himself.
There are states out there right now that if you were to win that state, it would more than make up the difference between first place and third place.
On Super Tuesday, you've got a lot of delegates up for grabs.
Yeah,
where do you think next Tuesday, where are you going to do well?
Well, we feel great in every one of those states and that we're going to pick up delegates in all of them. You know what I'm not going to do and get into this Joe Namath style, you know, prediction of we're going to win here or win there. We've never played that expectation game.
Senator Rubio says if the media and the GOP establishment say if only. It's that simple. Now, the haters and the rational might point out that the polls don't currently project a Rubio win in any of those states voting next Tuesday. But what it comes down to is this. When reality is too distasteful, sometimes you just have to squint. One place where Rubio did make a strong showing was Thursday night's GOP debate, which can be well summarized by this dignified exchange.
You're doing a great job. I have his book.
Okay, yeah, that, on your reality Trump TV show, not in
thank you, Donald. Thank you for the book.
That may have been the most shared moment, but the question that followed is likely to have far more serious repercussions.
But on the question of unlocking this cell phone of a terrorist, we should enforce the court order and find out everyone that terrorist in San Bernardino talked to on the phone, texted with, emailed, and absolutely Apple doesn't have a right to defy a valid court order in a terrorism investigation.
It's a showdown between one of the most powerful companies in the world, Apple, and the U.S. government. The FBI has obtained a court order for Apple to defeat the security features of the iPhone used by Saeed Farouk, the apparent ISIS wannabe behind December's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. Farouk died in a gun battle with police, and his iPhone password died with him. The FBI wants Apple to write new software to alter the self-destruct feature that wipes data clean from an iPhone after 10 incorrect password entries. Apple CEO Tim Cook has refused to cooperate because, he says, the code they're being asked to write would be
sort of the software equivalent of cancer.
As of this recording, other big tech companies, Microsoft, Google, Twitter, Facebook, Yahoo, all plan to file an amicus brief backing Apple in federal court next week. But Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate, says that this FBI versus Apple saga is being misleadingly framed as a grand fight between lofty principles of privacy versus national security. In fact, he says it may well be about future self-interest. Full disclosure, Fred is married to Brooke. Fred, welcome back to OTM.
Hi, Bob.
All right. Now, as we get into this, some of it is technical in terms of engineering and law. But what has been widely misreported is the basic claim that the FBI wants Apple to, quote, unlock the phone. In fact, as you write, the FBI wants to unlock the phone itself. But first, it has to defeat the self-destruct feature.
Right.
Would you please explain?
In the old days, the FBI or the NSA would come to a company with a court order saying we need either to tap this phone or to unlock this phone, and the company would do this. Then Apple created a new operating system, the iOS 8, where the customer sets the code. So if the government came to Apple and said, we want you to unlock this phone, and they would say, well, you know, I'd love to help, but we can't do it. I don't have the key. The customer has the key. It was created, in fact, as an evasion of government intrusion. So the FBI, or who knows, maybe the NSA, came up with an interesting workaround. They said, okay, look, we're not interested in you helping us unlock the phone, but there's this feature on your phone where if somebody tries to type out an inaccurate password 10 times, all the data are erased inside the phone. So what we would like you to do is just to wipe out that feature just on this one phone, and then we'll take some of this password-sniffing software that we have and do a brute force technique, which is just like throwing a million password guesses per second at the phone. And in a matter of hours or days or however long it takes, that will unlock the phone.
What exactly is the FBI seeking from that phone that it doesn't have already?
Well, see, this is unclear. There is a lot that they already have. Remember all the debates about metadata, the record of other phone numbers that a phone has called in the last 5 years? That information is on record with the carrier, and I'm sure that the FBI has already obtained it. If this were truly an urgent matter of national security, the NSA has ways to bust into telephones that you or I can't even imagine.
So whatever it is the FBI is seeking, and maybe it doesn't know itself what it's seeking, it's under the grounds of general investigation and not something necessarily urgent. But there are legal underpinnings to its request. Tell me, please, about the All Writs Act.
Well, the All Writs Act is something that was written in 1789, and it is the basis for all wiretaps in U.S. history. It basically allows the government to go to a third party to get help in getting information from somebody else.
But there are exceptions under the All Writs Act. And one of them is that fulfilling the court order will do harm to the entity that fulfills it, in this case, Apple. What's Cook's claim? Is this the cancer that he's talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it's a clause called unnecessary burden or undue burden. And he's arguing this is going to put undue burden on us. First, we have to write some code that doesn't exist. And second, this code could get out into the world to unlock any Apple phone or the FBI. Once it wins in this particular request, they could use that as a precedent for getting into any other phone on any other pretense. But more, there's a third exception, and that is that it's unnecessary, that you really don't need my help in this. And that's where the FBI might have to come up with some reason, given that they have the record of who this guy called on that phone and who called him. Is there really anything compelling in that data which requires Apple to turn over more information from the phone? And in fact, you know, the NSA director, Admiral Mike Rogers, said in one interview that the metadata did not reveal any foreign contacts on this phone. So it's a very knotty case. I think both sides are being disingenuous in that Apple really doesn't have a very good case for refusing to turn this over, given that they've turned over phones and unlocked them many times. On the other hand, the FBI is looking for something that probably isn't there, and I think Apple is right in this sense, that they are trying to create a precedent for strengthening the laws for overriding encryption or even for weakening encryption in the future.
Aha. And this gets to the thrust of your piece, which is that pay no attention to Syed Farouk's cell phone here. This is really just a red herring for both parties of this standoff. This is about the future. And you just didn't pull that out of your hat. You have reasons to think that there's a background game being played here.
Well, there was an article in Bloomberg Business Week that there was a National Security Council meeting in November where a memorandum was issued calling on all agencies to come up with ways to get around this tighter encryption. And I believe that this case will work very well in their favor, both legally and politically. So I think Apple has maneuvered itself into not a good position. This is not a great test case for them. And now that it's out in the public, my big worry is that should they happen to win the court case, given the present environment, especially an election year and so forth, I can imagine someone in Congress writing a law that will greatly expand the powers of government to get into phones and other devices and maybe put requirements on companies like Apple to put backdoors in phones.
Patriot Act 3, the revenge.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a little surprised that Tim Cook has made this into the big issue, the battlefield on which he is waging this ultimate fight for privacy rights, because I think legally, perhaps even morally and politically, he is on very shaky grounds with this.
Fred, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan is the national security columnist for Slate and author of Dark Territory: The Secret History of Cyber War. Coming up, the president takes another stab at closing Guantanamo, but this is on the media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It's been 7 years since President Obama signed an executive order to shut down the Guantanamo Bay detention facility.
The message that we are sending around the world is that the United States intends to prosecute the ongoing struggle against violence and terrorism, and we are going to do so vigilantly, we are going to do so effectively, and we are going to do so in a manner that is consistent with our values and our ideals.
That message to the world is languishing unsent. 91 men remain in custody there, down from 242 in 2009. This week, the president sent Congress a 9-page plan to finally close the prison and move the detainees to the mainland, and he articulated the principles behind affording them the basic protections of due process.
Keeping this facility open is contrary to our values. It undermines our standing in the world. It is viewed as a stain on our broader record of upholding the highest standards of rule of law.
The Republicans who control both houses of Congress have signaled not just no, but hell no. Here's Senator and presidential hopeful Marco Rubio.
When I'm president, if we capture a terrorist alive, they're not getting a court hearing in Manhattan. They're not going to be sent to Nevada. They're going to Guantanamo. And we're going to find out everything they know.
And yet, for all the opinions on what to do with the prison, public understanding of what's actually going on there is in short supply. Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald has been reporting from Gitmo since the first detainees arrived there back in January 2002. She joins us from Guantanamo. Carol, welcome back to On the Media.
Hey, Bob.
A busy week, Carol, at Guantanamo, and not just over the president's speech.
Well, we have ongoing September 11th pretrial hearings going on. The five men accused of putting together the 9/11 plot led by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They're trying to figure out what evidence from the CIA black sites where they were held before they got to Guantanamo will be used at their death penalty trials. I think what's interesting about this is everybody expects the 9/11 trial to be about what happened on September 11th, but we're not there yet. We're talking about what happened in the black sites and what's happening at Guantanamo.
In fact, introduced as evidence by the defense are some film clips from Zero Dark Thirty, the movie. How is that material to these cases?
I'm telling you, it was really creepy. They did film clips of the torture in a CIA black site of a character named Ammar.
What's the target? Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden? Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden, huh?
You know, when you lie to me, I hurt you.
The place was just silent. And in court, one of the accused is named Ammar al-Baluchi, and his lawyer says Hollywood got more about what happened to his client in the black sites than he's gotten through discovery. He wants the judge to order the Pentagon, the CIA, the U.S. government, to tell him what they told the filmmakers Mark Bull and Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty.
Now, the president made this Hail Mary pass with a plan to closed down Guantanamo. But did news of the request reach the inmates there?
That's a very good question that the prison will not answer. I actually tried to get the spokesman for the prison, which has become more and more reclusive lately. I tried to get him to see if the guards noticed them watching the president's speech. You know, they have TV in their cell blocks. And I got a resounding no information. That's the way it works at Guantanamo prison these days.
Now, I want to understand this right. So the president is saying, let's shut down Gitmo and bring these people to the mainland. But he's not talking about inserting them into the civilian criminal justice system. All of the other rules of detention apply. It's just that they wouldn't be in Cuba anymore. So there would still be a virtual Guantanamo?
Sure. That's the reason we call the stateside vision Guantanamo North. I mean, it's convenient journalism, but it's Guantanamo North. They want to remove the taint of the orange jumpsuit. The vision picks up these men who are in military detention and takes them to military detention in the United States. And they're still talking about these indefinite detainees for whom there's no charges, but they're too afraid to let go. That's why the critics say you're picking it up and moving it, but you're not in any way abandoning the Bush administration doctrine, which says forever prisoners of a forever war. They can leave when the hostilities are over. What they've tried to do in this plan is say they'll be more discerning. They'll get more trials. They'll find ways to maybe charge some people in federal court. And if they're convicted, they'll go to federal prison just like any other criminal. But there are a number of people not identified in that report because they don't know who will not be charged, who will not get trials, and who will be basically war prisoners. And one of the most, to me, fascinating overlooked portions of the plan is that one of the justifications for it is that it crunches saving $1.8 billion through 2036. It envisions this Guantanamo North as existing for 20 years. Now do the math. These men, most of them were captured right after the September 11th attacks. This is 35 years detention. Some of them never charged, never tried.
And this gets to some very deep divisions, political divisions, philosophical ones, ideological ones, about what constitutes the American way. The president called Guantanamo a stain on the country's record of upholding the rule of law. Here's Texas Senator and another GOP presidential hopeful, Ted Cruz, on the same subject.
Don't shut down Gitmo. Expand it, and let's have some new terrorists there.
There's two things at work there. One is the president and the Congress see completely different messages by the existence of a Guantanamo. Meaning, the president says, you know, I go around the world and people see this as a lawlessness of a unwilling to work within the international community. And I think, you know, members of Congress really like Guantanamo. They like the message it sends, which is mess with America and you end up in a cage at Guantanamo Bay. But the other part of it is, and I think you get a bit of that in the campaign, Obama, by closing the prison, is trying to draw the curtain on Guantanamo-style detention. It'll still be there. Guantanamo, by any other name, is still Guantanamo. But the Republicans, they don't want to end the Guantanamo experiment. They want to grow the Guantanamo experiment. And they want to fill it up with people to be interrogated to get actionable intelligence. And that's a different message entirely.
So let's just say a miracle takes place and the president prevails, that Gitmo is closed even before he leaves office. The detainees, what's left of them, moved to Guantanamo North. What does that mean to reporters trying to keep track of the various prosecutions? Does it make it easier? Harder?
So I think their vision still would have a 9/11 trial, just like this week, with them bringing in the 9/11 accused and reporters watching on a 40-second delay. But do I think that over at the prison, Guantanamo North, not where the court is, we'll get the kind of access we got at the beginning? Absolutely not. You have to remember, when Guantanamo was set up, January 2002, the American psyche was so raw. Everybody felt they were in this together. They were bringing these prisoners in orange jumpsuits from Afghanistan. They thought they had the right people. Frankly, against all reason, but the military wanted reporters at the detention center. They wanted to send the message that we got them. What's happened in the intervening period is the abuse reports from Abu Ghraib, but also sometimes from Gitmo. So much has happened in the interim that the military doesn't want us here. I think if they manage to build Guantanamo North, there'll be even less access to eyes on prisoners than there are now. I also will tell you that for me, unless they build that thing in South Florida, I'm out of it. I got this assignment because it was in Cuba, it was in our backyard, and because the military invited me personally, come on down and watch us build the detention center. I just don't know that the next people who build that prison, if they ever get to build that prison, are going to be inviting me to it.
Well, Carol, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, Bob.
Carol Rosenberg covers the Guantanamo detainees for the Miami Herald. You can and should find her work at miamiherald.com/Guantanamo. Guantanamo. Cody Pomplin is an associate editor at the Brookings Institution's national security law and policy website, Lawfare. He, too, paid close attention to the president's address on Gitmo, especially this statement.
It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit.
That's a long-held claim asserted again at a congressional hearing last year. Pomplin wondered, is it true? How much does Guantanamo figure into jihadist propaganda and recruitment materials? And so he investigated.
We started by looking at some well-known terrorist media, ISIS's Dabiq magazine, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's Inspire. We also looked at transcripts from execution videos released by ISIS. Overall, I reviewed hundreds of documents and thousands of pages looking for mentions of Guantanamo and noting each time how it was used and the way that it was invoked.
That is certainly not the entirety of, nor necessarily even representative of, the entire universe of jihadist media. There are message boards, informal social media networks, and so on that probably contain the lion's share of this kind of rhetoric.
Right. Social media accounts, Twitter, Telegram, do make up a large portion of recruitment efforts as well as jihadist online forums. And we weren't able to approach those in a systematic fashion. You know, it's possible that Guantanamo may play a more profound role in those media. But I think one of the things that we really thought about was that what should be animating recruitment and what should be pushing people to join are the statements of leaders. And to back that up, you know, ISIS's kind of chief spokesman, Abu al-Adnani, once said, if someone wants to get to know the program of the Islamic State, its politics, and its legal opinions, they ought to consult its leaders, their statements, public addresses, and sources.
So as you do look into the totality of terrorist media, what did you find? Is this stuff just thick with Guantanamo references or not?
What we found is that it's complicated. Al-Qaeda, including leaders like bin Laden and Zawahiri, have talked about Guantanamo Bay as long as it's been open. They use it to discredit U.S. policy and portray the U.S.'s involvement as part of a larger, unprovoked war against Muslims. For example, in a 2003 letter, Osama bin Laden called on Allah to, quote, free our brothers who the tyrants have jailed in America, Guantanamo, occupied Palestine, and Riyadh. ISIS does mention Guantanamo, but in over 700 pages of propaganda material, they only mentioned it four times. So it does come up, but it's never a major theme. It doesn't really animate recruitment, and the salience seems to have waned over time. When you start to look at the relative value of the facility contrasted to kind of the other major themes, it really pales in comparison.
Compared to, for example, Zionism or Crusade.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. 387 mentions in those 700 pages of the word Crusade, calling the United States and its Arab allies, the new Crusaders, the creation of Israel, the subsequent invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan as part of a broader assault on Muslims and the land of Islam. And those attacks have to be met with violent jihad. All of that comes up way more often. Guantanamo at times provides a supporting argument to justify the stance that America is a part of this crusade. And it certainly serves as a counterpoint to U.S. claims of benevolence and supporting justice and human rights. But the point which Joe Biden has made before, where he called Guantanamo the, quote, greatest propaganda tool that exists for recruiting terrorists around the world, is almost false on its face. The narrative of jihadist propaganda operates at a far higher level than a single facility in the Caribbean.
As you sifted through all of this material, you know, apart from the invocation of Guantanamo, was there any kind of other Easter egg that you discovered that simply had not dawned on you before to be a big issue?
I think what's interesting is just how many ways there are to criticize the United States. And what I mean by that is that various jihadist platforms, you know, have certainly criticized the United States for Guantanamo, the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, drawings of the Prophet Muhammad and drone strikes, things you might expect. But also, you know, Osama bin Laden wrote, I think, a 10-page article criticizing the United States' approach to climate change and calling on the United States to be a global leader in this regard, basically saying that its refusal to engage seriously on the issue is a type of neo-imperialism in support of its capitalist traditions, etc. It can almost be a spaghetti on the wall type approach, right? Throw as many things as you can, as many criticisms as you can, and see what sticks. And the more you put out there, the more you're able to discredit and damage what Al-Qaeda has called the, quote, media halo surrounding the United States, then the more likely you are to peel people away from supporting them and perhaps support your own movement. I have a quote here, actually, from Ayman al-Zawahiri, which I think really shows Guantanamo is just one of a litany of criticisms against the United States. In this quote, he criticizes the United States for its major corporations, deceitful media, spreading obscenity, gambling, alcohol, family breakups, using women as merchandise to gain customers, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, carpet bombings, cluster bombs, Afghanistan, Iraq, Halliburton.
Anything in there about the designated hitter rule?
No, not quite.
Now, you dug into these publicly available magazines and websites and so forth. The United States government has the entire Central Intelligence Agency at its beck and call. It's hard for me to imagine that these statistics were inaccessible to them. Are the president and the vice president lying?
I would certainly not say the president and the vice president are lying. They may be interpreting the data differently, and that may be because they have a preferred outcome to this discussion. You can look at this and say, well, jihadists do mention Guantanamo Bay, and if even one person has been drawn to that ideology because of it, then that's one too many. That's a different argument than the argument that it is the greatest recruiting tool of Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, and that that is principally what is pushing people to violent extremism. Jihadists are also going to criticize almost every policy the United States engages in that counters their own interests. So no, I don't think that they're lying. I think that there's just perhaps a disagreement about the relative importance of the findings.
So in the unlikely event that Congress takes the president up on his request and furnishes the funds for the closing of Guantanamo in Cuba and the moving of virtual Guantanamo to the mainland, do you think that's going to have any influence on jihadist recruitment?
I think the influence would be marginal. And primarily that's because I think that its impact right now is marginal, so closing it won't change very much. And if the president's policy is really just to relocate the facility with the exact same policies, it's really not clear why, under the administration's logic, the facility would no longer factor into jihadist recruitment. I mean, even Secretary of Defense Ash Carter has called it, quote-unquote, Gitmo North. I don't see that jihadists are going to look at that and say, oh, well, now that's taken care of. I guess we can't talk about that anymore.
Cody, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was a pleasure.
Cody Poplin is a research assistant at the Brookings Institution and an associate editor of the Brookings website, Lawfare. Coming up, the vigilante life on both sides of the Mexican border. This is On the Media.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. A new documentary called Cartel Land by filmmaker Matthew Heineman is an intimate look at vigilante groups on both sides of the Mexican border fighting against official impotence, or worse, to protect their communities from the drug trade. In the film, Heineman captures extraordinary moments of violence, corruption, cult of personality, and even adultery, all recorded with the subject's full participation. Cartel Land has already won George Polk and Directors Guild's awards for documentary journalism. Now, it's up for an Oscar. Or, depending on when you're hearing this, maybe already snagged one. Matthew, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have to take care about spoilers, but to me, the greatest thing about your film is the juxtaposition of the opening sequence where we see two cartel workers preparing to cook a whole mess of meth with the closing, which features a kind of pullback to reveal, and that shocking reveal tells us everything about the polluted ecosystem that is the Mexican drug trade. And to get this footage, you had to be in the middle of the Mexican desert, in the middle of the night, with narcos. Holy hell.
That is a scene that I fought so hard to get. Michoacan, where I was filming, is an incredibly resource-rich area. You know, if you go out tonight and you go have a taco, the avocado is most likely coming from Michoacan. If you go have a mojito, the lime is most likely coming from Michoacan. If you go do meth tonight, the meth is most likely coming from Michoacan. So meth was a really, really important part of this story. And every single shoot, I'd go down there and, you know, ask somebody, do you know somebody, you know somebody, you know somebody, you know somebody who's quote-unquote connected. And week after week, month after month, we failed. And then it was on what I thought was our last shoot. We got a call saying, be in this town square at 6 p.m. and you're in. We went to this town square and a group of masked men met us. And before this, we had set up ground rules. My rule was that I didn't want my face to be bagged or to be thrown in the back of a trunk. And their rule was that they wanted their faces to be covered. And so these masked men drove us through these towns and smaller towns and then fields and then smaller fields. And we get out into this forest and, you know, here's this mobile meth lab. The sun is dipping beneath the mountain and it's basically pitch black. And I don't shoot with lights, and so I couldn't see a darn thing with my camera. And I couldn't believe I'd fought for so long to get into this position and suddenly couldn't see anything. And then the head chef starts showing me around the lab with this little flashlight. It's with this little flashlight that I lit the scene.
You're very much prepared for this situation based on all your years covering war and violence and terrorism. So this is like right up your alley. What was your last film about?
Healthcare, which is a different type of battle, shall we say. Yeah, I was not prepared at all for any of this stuff. You know, this film led me into shootouts, into torture chambers, and, you know, here into this meth lab that we're discussing. And, you know, I'd never been in any situation like this before.
Which makes one wonder how you got from healthcare policy to the middle of the desert.
Well, I'd read this Rolling Stone article about these vigilantes on the U.S. side of the border. It was a world that just fascinated me. I knew nothing about it. I was really intrigued by sort of what provokes men and women to, you know, quote-unquote, take the law into their own hands. And so I reached out to this journalist, Damon Tabor. He introduced me to Tim Naylor Foley, who led this group called Arizona Border Recon. And I spent about 7 months gaining his trust.
Okay, you began with Tim Foley, who was an American veteran and heads this group that is equal parts right-wing militia and neighborhood watch. Here's Foley from the beginning of your film.
Technically, we're vigilantes upholding the law where there is no law. But the phrase vigilante, it's been given a bad name by the media.
They are heavily armed and claim to be protecting our state from foreign threats and from our own government. But the state's growing militia movement is causing concern among law enforcement.
But
back in the day, vigilante wasn't a bad thing. Say the bandits was riding into your town, the townspeople would all get together and, you know, defend their town.
He was extraordinarily reticent about taking part at first. You know, he had deep distrust of the media, of the quote-unquote, you know, New York liberal media, which I was apparently a part of. And so we'd talk on the phone once a week, once every couple of weeks. And I told him, I'm not going to bring my own personal beliefs into this experience. You know, I really want to allow you to be yourself and to let the story unfold as it would unfold naturally. So many documentary films put people in nice, neat little boxes. And, you know, my goal was to not do that.
You said you didn't want to arbitrarily put people in a box. Sometimes they constructed the box for themselves. There is this little rant from one of Tim Foley's militia members, which is kind of self-indicting.
The reason I come down here is to do something about having a porous border. The truth is, tall fences make for better neighbors, especially if you have conflicting ideas. You wouldn't put two pit bulls in the same pen and expect them to get along and not fight. Why would you put two races in the same nation and expect them to get along?
When you heard this explicitly racist explanation for this guy's motivation, what kind of box did that put you in as a filmmaker if you don't want to stereotype?
You know, I didn't want to stereotype, but I also wanted to, you know, be honest and truthful as to why they're down there. To not show this would not be telling, you know, an honest and truthful portrait of what's happening down there.
Now, you do spend quite a bit of time with Arizona border recon in the film, but clearly the larger part of your documentary concerns a kind of mirror image group, albeit much larger, on the other side of the border called Autodefensas. Tell me who they are and how you got onto them.
So I'd been filming in Arizona for about 4 or 5 months, and then my father sent me this article about the Autodefensas, a group of citizens in the Mexican state of Michoacan, west of Mexico City, you know, deep down in Mexico, who were rising up to fight back against the Knights Templar cartel, a vicious, vicious cartel. And almost immediately, I wanted to make this parallel story of vigilantism on both sides of the border. I reached out to a journalist that had written a profile piece on the leader of this group, El Doctor Jose Manuel Morales. And I asked her, you know, what's he like as a character? And she said he's the single most interesting man I've ever been around.
Tall, handsome, charitable, brave.
And these deep, dark eyes, as she described them. Even if a quarter of what she said was true, those are music to any documentary filmmaker's ears. 2 weeks later, we were in Mexico filming. And I thought I was going to be down there for 1 or 2 weeks. And 1 or 2 weeks turned into 9 months. I was down there for about 1 or 2 weeks of every month for 9 months.
And what a 9 months. You filmed Autodefensas beating up cartel members. You filmed one of the bosses giving an order to kill one of the cartel members. You filmed shootouts. You documented the mutation of Autodefensas into a criminal gang in its own right. Late in the film, you record the sainted El Doctor Mireles hitting on, actually more than just hitting on, a young girl 40 years his junior and not his wife. I repeat, Matthew, holy hell. Tell me again why you aren't in a shallow grave somewhere.
That's something I don't necessarily like to think about too much, I guess. There's obviously an element of good fortune and luck. The truth be told, though, you know, I definitely had an element of protection by being, you know, a white American, by having a blue passport. Since 2000, 90 journalists have been killed covering the drug wars in Mexico. You know, that being said, you know, when you're out in the middle of the desert, if you're in the middle of a shootout, you know, the bullets don't really care what zip code you're from. So I feel very fortunate. And I owe an enormous amount to my amazing and tiny crew, especially my local fixer, Daniel Fernandez.
There are a couple of scenes that if you're a documentarian and you understand what is being said, you're probably shaking because you realize how important the film is that you're recording. And after El Doctor Mireles is injured in an apparent murder attempt, his fill-in to lead Autodefensas while he's out is a character known as Papa Smurf. And at one critical point, Papa Smurf is addressing the citizens of a town that Autodefensas hopes to liberate from the cartel as it has liberated other towns in the region.
That scene, actually, you know, I'd filmed about 20 Papa Smurf speeches. So I was like, I can't film another one of these. And for whatever reason, the light was twinkling in a certain way. I decided, you know, I'm going to film one more. And it turned out to be this amazing scene in which this town, you know, challenges him. This man in the crowd challenges him and asks him, who gives you the authority to do what you do? You know, you're robbing our houses. You come in with your guns. You're flirting with our women. You know, who gives you the authority to do this? We joked in the edit room. You know, we called this guy Charlie Rose because he asked all the questions that, you know, that we as audience members wanted to know.
And this is the turning point because he's identified what we've begun to suspect but really aren't quite sure of as an audience, which is that Auto Defensas, especially without El Doctor Mireles, has lost its moral center and really mutated into the very sort of criminal organization that it's supposed to defend people against. Did you know at that point where this film was headed?
At that point, I had an inkling of what was happening for sure. You know, at first it really seemed like it was a story of good versus evil, of everyday citizens fighting back against the evil cartel. And things changed pretty quickly, and these lines between good and evil became ever more blurry until, you know, by the end of the film, they were almost indistinguishable. You know, I could be on a mission on an aperitivo. I could be in the back of a truck and look to my left or look to my right and not know if I was with the cartel or the people fighting the cartel or something in between, you know, as we see in the end of the film. You know, it's a really, really complicated maze to navigate as all these allegiances were shifting, as people were literally and figuratively changing shirts. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to do in editing this film, was to allow you as an audience member to go on that same journey that I went on. All those moments where I thought I understood what was happening, but things changed, either about my character or about the movement itself, I wanted you to feel those same moments. All those moments where I felt like the rug was pulled out from under me, I wanted you to feel those same moments as well.
Among the other things that are profound about this film is that at one point it becomes kind of a cinematic Milgram experiment, where before we really understand how far Auto Defensas has gone to the side of evil, we hear them interrogating cartel members or suspected cartel members, and we hear in the background the sounds of people being tortured. And at this stage, I am not saying to myself, oh my God, these people are evil. They're torturing these guys. As an audience, I'm going, wait, oh my God, they're torturing. But, well, these are brutal killers. It's not plain to me that some moral corner has been turned. It's not long. But even then, I'm still personally kind of delivering the shock, or at least standing by with my arms folded while the shock's being delivered. How about you?
You know, that's one of the things that constantly plagued me and would keep me up at night. You know, what would I do? What would I do if my brother was hanging from a bridge or my sister was raped? You know, would I grab a gun? Is it okay to fight violence with violence? You know, is vigilantism sustainable? These are all questions that drew me into this world and constantly pushed me, both intellectually, emotionally, and physically, to make this film. You know, I would sneak into this room, this large bathroom that they used to interrogate people. You know, I would record sound. I would pretend like I was going to the bathroom. I would go into a stall and record sound. I would walk into this room and pretend, you know, like I was having conversations, and I would record, because to not capture this, to me, would be wrong. You know, this was part of the fabric of what made this movement what it was. I felt, you know, a huge duty and obligation to show it.
One thing I can reveal about the scene that reveals so much is that two of these meth cooks have a fatalistic view of the drug trade and all of the collateral damage. They say this.
Of course, cartels, mafia, whatever you want to call it, are involved in this. They're involved in everything. I mean, some way, somehow, everybody has gone corrupted. The Auto Defenders and the people cooking meth, we're pretty much the same team. We're actually helping fund the Auto Defenders. Us selling drugs or cooking drugs, it just doesn't look right. But it will always happen. You can't stop the cartel, no matter what you do. It's either Michoacan cooks it, Sinaloa cooks it, Guerrero cooks it. It's just never gonna stop, period.
Is he right? Is it ever going to stop?
I think, you know, the elephant in the room is, you know, America's voracious appetite for drugs. You know, it's basic supply and demand. It's basic economics. As long as there's a demand for drugs here in the States, you know, there'll be a supply of drugs coming from Mexico and South America. And with that, the violence that's resulted since 2007 in 100,000 plus people being killed. And, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I really wanted to highlight with this film is that, you know, there's a war that's happening in the country just south of us, resulting in so many deaths and so much terror and fear and suffering. You know, and we're connected to this. We're responsible for this to some degree.
Matthew, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Heineman is the filmmaker behind Cartel Land, which this weekend is up for the Best Documentary Oscar. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Meera Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mythili Rao. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina and David Conrad, and our show was edited by this week executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Means and Casey Holford. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.